KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Negotiators from Russia and Ukraine met separately with U.S. officials in Saudi Arabia.
The goal is to iron out details of a potential limited ceasefire in the Black Sea.
We'll bring you the latest. Today is Monday, March 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump has been issuing memos and executive orders targeting big law firms.
We speak with a lawyer who left her firm, calling on her employer to speak out against the administration's moves.
I think that picking a fight with big law is one prong of his multi-pronged attack on the judiciary system.
And what the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic saw after he was mistakenly added to a group chat with top Trump administration officials.
I did not think that the CIA and the Defense Department would invite the editor of The Atlantic into a chat about bombing Yemen.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration accidentally texted top secret war plans to a journalist. The mistake is causing an uproar. NPR's Maura Liasson reports hours after it came out, President Trump said he didn't know anything about it.
The editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, says he was included in a Signal group chat where Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared war plans, including precise information about weapons and targets, hours before the U.S. attacked the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Goldberg said at first he thought it was disinformation, maybe generated by AI. But then when the bombs started falling, he knew it was real. Members of Congress and former defense secretaries said the breach was amateurish and incompetent. A spokesman for the National Security Council said the message thread appears to be authentic and that the White House is reviewing how an inadvertent number was added to the chain. When asked, President Trump said he didn't know anything about the disclosure, but that he isn't a big fan of The Atlantic magazine. Maura Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Hegseth, one question a short while ago, said, quote, nobody was texting war plans and disparaged Goldberg. Today, the Department of Education is nearly half the size it was on Friday. That's because of agency-wide cuts to the workforce there, Jonky Mehta reports.
At the end of the workday Friday, nearly half the workforce of the Department of Education began paid administrative leave. The layoffs hit every division of the department. Among the hardest hit was the National Center for Education Sciences, or NCES. In part, those experts were responsible for crunching the numbers that determine which school districts qualify for certain federal grants. Without them, it's unclear whether schools in low-income communities will receive key grants like Title I, which sets aside billions of dollars for 90% of school districts across the nation. NCES employees told NPR they were confident districts would get the money they expect for next school year, but the fate of federal grants for future years hangs in the balance. Jonky Mehta, NPR News.
The UN is pulling some international staff out of Gaza after an Israeli tank hit a UN compound last week. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
According to spokesman Stéphane Dujarric, the UN will be pulling out about a third of its 100 international staffers currently in Gaza. He says this is because of devastating Israeli airstrikes that have claimed the lives of hundreds of civilians in Gaza, including UN personnel.
As a result, the Secretary General has taken the difficult decision to reduce the United Nations footprint in Gaza, even as humanitarian needs soar and our concern over the protection of civilians intensifies.
He says the UN is not leaving Gaza and is determined to continue to help Palestinians there, but Israel has cut off aid for more than 3 weeks now. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow was up 597 points. This is NPR. President Trump appears to be doubling down on his assertion that Greenland should agree to be acquired by the U.S. After a meeting with cabinet members, Trump says Greenland is important for U.S. security and said his administration is working with people in Greenland, though he did not elaborate. Greenland's outgoing prime minister, meanwhile, called an upcoming visit to Greenland by a U.S. delegation that includes the wife of President J.D. Vance, Ursula Vance, a provocation. He said his government will not meet with the group. French actor Gerard Depardieu arrived at a Paris courthouse today. He's facing trial on multiple sexual assault charges, which he denies. Rebecca Rossman reports two women say the 76-year-old assaulted them on a film set in 2021.
Depardieu walked into court without saying a word, but his silence won't last long. After years of sexual assault and rape allegations from over a dozen women, this marks the first time the famed French actor will take the witness stand, a moment many are calling pivotal for France's stalled Me Too movement. The trial was originally set to take place in October, but was delayed due to Depardieu's ill health. Depardieu's accusers, whose names have not been made public, allege that he groped them on set of the 2022 film Les Volets Verts. If convicted, Depardieu could face up to 5 years in prison and an $80,000 fine. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
Crude oil futures prices followed stocks higher today. Oil up 1% after the Trump administration proposed imposing a 25% tariff on countries that buy oil from Venezuela. Oil rose 83 cents a barrel to settle at $69.11 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. American and Russian negotiators met in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, today, and on the agenda was organizing a ceasefire with Ukraine in the Black Sea. The closed-door talks followed American consultations with a Ukrainian delegation on Sunday, also about a ceasefire. Now, both sides have made ceasefire pledges before, and both sides have not met them. So let's ask our correspondents Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv and Charles Maines in Moscow for insight on what this all might actually mean. Hey to both of you.
Hello to you, Elsa.
Hi.
All right, Charles, can we start with you? Can you just tell us more about today's talks?
Yeah, you know, the U.S.'s goal going into these meetings was to negotiate a partial maritime ceasefire in the Black Sea. Mm-hmm. Russia had made clear it was willing to explore a return to the contours of this so-called Black Sea Grain Initiative. That agreement was crafted by the United Nations with backing from Turkey in 2022, and it allowed safe passage and inspection of ships carrying grain and fertilizer through the Black Sea, really at a moment when there was a global food shortage. The deal eventually collapsed amid Russian complaints. The agreement benefited Ukraine while failing to lift sanction-related restrictions on Russian agricultural trade. But it appears the White House hasn't reassured Russia enough on that front, at least not yet. The Kremlin says despite some 10 hours of discussions, no documents will be signed.
Okay, and Eleanor, as we mentioned, there were talks with Ukraine on Sunday. What was the focus there?
Well, you know, Ukraine was the first to agree to a comprehensive ceasefire, so land, sea, and air. Mm-hmm. The Kremlin did not agree with that. And Ukraine has been pushing to broaden what has been agreed upon, a ceasefire with energy facilities. It's trying to broaden that to include civilian infrastructure like railways and ports and also cities. People are increasingly doubtful that these talks are sincere because of Russia's recent attacks on Ukraine's cities. Over the weekend, there was a massive drone attack on Kyiv that killed three people, including a five-year-old. And today, a missile hit residential areas in the northeastern town of Sumy, including a school and a hospital. And this has really undermined what little faith Ukrainians had in this process with the Russians. You know, I witnessed that drone swarm Saturday night and went to an apartment block that had been hit and where people died the next day. And people I talked to do not believe Russia is sincere about the peace or even a ceasefire. And today, a Ukrainian parliament member said Putin is paying lip service to the Trump administration's call for a truce, but his actions show something completely different.
All right, so a lot of distrust there. Well, Charles, what are Russia's key demands at this point? Like, how is the Kremlin framing these negotiations?
Well, the Kremlin spokesman today said that Russia values the American diplomatic efforts, but it made clear that they saw this as a long process. So with more talks, more negotiations needed to work out a range of technicalities towards an eventual ceasefire. In the meantime, Russia doesn't seem to be offering much of anything in the way of concessions, and maybe the question is, why should they? You know, the Trump administration appears to agree with them on many of Russia's core demands. We've already heard Trump say no to NATO membership for Ukraine and talk about Ukraine making territorial concessions to Russia. Well, this weekend, the White House's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, in an interview with the former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, went further. Witkoff endorsed Russia's seizure of four Ukrainian territories based on referendum votes the U.S. and indeed the entire West had regarded as a complete sham.
Yeah, meanwhile, as Eleanor notes, Russia continues to attack, right?
Right, and it doesn't look like that will change. You know, there's this larger argument you hear in Moscow. Why compromise what the Kremlin seems to think it can take on the battlefield? So these temporary ceasefire proposals, whether they hold up or not, at least address two areas, oil facilities, gas facilities, and, say, attacks on naval ships, where Russia's, you know, remained vulnerable to Ukrainian attacks. Critics will say the Kremlin is now slow-walking on Trump's larger goal of a full ceasefire while Putin presses Russia's current military advantage. You know, meanwhile, he seems to be finding some sympathy in Washington for his larger goal, a neutered NATO presence near Russia's borders. But really, that can only come through negotiations with Trump. And the process itself, you know, seems to restore Russia's stature as a global power on equal footing with the U.S.
You know, talking to both of you, I'm just struck by how different everything feels with the Trump administration compared to the last 3 years. Like, not just this focus on ceasefire talks from the U.S., but also the warmth from the U.S. towards Russia compared to towards Ukraine these days, right? Like, how are people in Moscow and Kyiv taking in this whole new dynamic?
Well, Elsa, you're absolutely right about that. You know, the Ukrainians feel like they're negotiating a totally new landscape, and it's very difficult. The Biden administration was always sympathetic to their struggle, while the Trump administration is at times hostile, and you have administration officials actually spreading misinformation or what they say are Kremlin talking points. And despite all these hints that the Trump administration is cozying up to the Kremlin, Ukrainians just don't want to believe that their most important ally is abandoning them quite yet.
Yeah, you know, Elsa, to get just a sense of how things have shifted from Moscow's view, I think look no further than that Witkoff interview I mentioned with Tucker Carlson. You know, Witkoff said Putin had commissioned and even gifted a painting of Trump and revealed he'd even prayed for the president after that assassination attempt in Pennsylvania last summer. So this is bigger than just Ukraine. This is about a full reset in U.S.-Russian relations.
Absolutely. That is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow and Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump promised retribution on the campaign trail. So far as president, he's not just targeting government agencies. He's also going after private law firms.
We have a lot of law firms that we're going to be going after because they were very dishonest people. They were very, very dishonest. I could go point after point after point.
Speaking there to Fox News, it is not clear what he meant by dishonesty, but it is clear that his actions target lawyers who challenged his first administration or who helped pursue legal battles against him. Trump has issued executive orders sanctioning specific firms, and on Friday night, he issued an executive memo threatening sanctions on any law firms that pursue, quote, frivolous, unreasonable, and vexatious litigation against the United States, end quote. Rachel Cohen has spoken up about all of this on her social media in an open letter, and recently in a viral all-staff email resigning from her firm, Skadden Arps, if it would not stand up in response to these executive actions. Attorney Rachel Cohen joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel, when you gave your 2 weeks notice, you wrote, I'm going to quote you here, do not pretend that what is happening is normal or excusable. So I'd like to start by asking you, what was the breaking point for you that pushed you to resign?
The breaking point was a combination of two things. The first was feeling confident that I had done everything in my power other than resigning. But what was ultimately the triggering event was Paul Weiss's decision to capitulate to the Trump administration to get him to rescind an executive order that he had issued against them. I think it's important to note that the Paul Weiss executive order was issued after a judge had already issued a temporary restraining order for a very, very similar executive order levied against the law firm Perkins Coie. In a normal functioning American legal dynamic, you would never issue a near identical executive order to one that had just been functionally enjoined. And a law firm certainly would not then refuse to fight that executive order.
I just want to take a second to spell out some of the details of the Paul Weiss case for people who may not be as familiar with it as you are. President Trump levied this executive order to strip the firm of security clearances and government contracts, in part because it rehired a lawyer who'd left the firm to prosecute a case against Trump, and then Paul Weiss agreed to concessions to get the executive order rescinded that included $40 million in pro bono work in cases aligning with the administration's agenda. Spell out for me why that is so troubling to you.
There's two pieces of the settlement that troubled me, and you've identified them. The first is this agreement to provide the $40 million in pro bono legal services. And so you have associates at a firm that has always held itself out to be kind of at the cutting edge of important pro bono work and justice work in addition to their billable obligations. You have these associates that are now being told that their firm is going to provide millions of dollars worth of free legal support to the Trump administration to advance its aims. So that's the first thing. But the second thing that troubled me is that they committed to a total evaluation by an outside evaluator to be agreed between Paul Weiss and the Trump administration of their hiring practices. I have many friends in the industry that expressed fear of doxing or being pushed out as associates who are non-white within this industry. If Paul Weiss is giving him this, and it makes me certain that other firms are going to give him this, I think I have to trust that they are and be proactive here.
Now, Paul Weiss took in over $2.6 billion in revenue last year, according to Law 360, and its chairman said in an internal email, even given that figure, I'm quoting, "It was very likely that our firm would not be able to survive a protracted dispute with the administration." Hearing that, what does that say about the state of the legal profession at this moment?
I think if I hear that and I'm a client, I'm questioning why I'm paying $3,000 an hour for a law firm that doesn't think it can win a legal battle over an executive order that has functionally already been enjoined.
In your view, what do you think President Trump is trying to do in picking this fight with Big Law?
I think that picking a fight with Big Law is one prong of his multi-pronged attack on the judiciary system. He's intimidating judges. He is ignoring judges' orders and deporting people over them. And I think that his goal here is to kneecap effective pro bono representation and public interest representation challenging him. The Trump administration's telling us, I don't care how the courts decide, but also it's even easier for me if there aren't lawyers willing to go there in the first place.
Apart from rhetoric, is there anything that you see that law firms can do collectively here?
I think that the first step collectively is going to be rhetoric. It's going to be putting out a statement saying, we're committed to continued representation, whether it is representation that the Trump administration views as supportive of it or adverse to it. But then the next step of collective action has to be putting their money where their mouth is. I'm not focused on that piece at this moment because right now I can't even get their mouth there.
That was attorney Rachel Cohen. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Congressional Democrats have been under pressure from constituents to be more aggressive in opposing President Trump. Progressive stars Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responded recently with a series of rallies.
We need a Democratic Party that fights harder for us, too.
These events drew big crowds in states like Colorado and Arizona, but some in the Democratic Party say rallying the base is not enough. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports.
Democrats on Capitol Hill know they have essentially no power right now, but that could all change if they can win just 3 House seats next year. Those seats are likely to come from areas that voted for President Trump in November, and Democrats who represent those districts say they know how to win.
We can't just resist. It can't just be why we're against Trump and what's wrong with Trump.
That's New York Congressman Tom Suozzi, one of 13 Democrats who won alongside Trump in their districts. In his case, voters swung from former President Joe Biden in 2020 to Trump 4 years later.
So something's going on. I think that the Democratic brand has been damaged.
He says Republicans have done a better job at marketing their ideas.
When you ask people, you say, what do the Republicans stand for? They say, well, make America great again. They want to cut the size of government. They want to give tax cuts. Stuff like that. What do the Democrats stand for? And I think that people are kind of scratching their head a little bit. You know, they believe in, like, choice and LGBT rights, which I believe in those things, too. But I don't know if you can build a whole party around that.
He nods to his own campaign, where he won on an issue that traditionally puts Democrats on defense, immigration.
I was running on the issue of the border. So the consultants come to me and they say, well, Tom, you know, that's a Republican issue. I don't know if you should be talking. I said, no, this is what the people in my district are talking about. We can't ignore what the people are talking about.
Fellow Democrat Marcy Kaptur of Ohio says another key element for Democrats is to expand their coalition and bring people who voted for Trump into the fold.
They heard President Trump say, make America great again. That was something they want to do. And they know where they live isn't. They've seen factories close. So we need to keep our eyes laser beam focused on how do we expand opportunity.
She says Democrats haven't messaged clear enough plans on how to grow the economy.
I have different mottos I live by, and one of them is economics is not destiny, but it is 85% of it. And the Democrats better shape up and put together a plan for progress, starting in the places that have fallen behind, where people are voting for change simply because the economy is not working for them.
And articulating that new plan is not just for current members.
Our bench needs to be reinvigorated.
That's Colorado Congressman Jason Crow, who was tapped to help lead recruitment.
People want folks who have built businesses, raised families, maybe served as a sheriff's deputy, a nurse, who understand what it's like to maybe not know where your rent or mortgage money is going to come from for next month.
He's already had success in this arena. He flipped his own seat in 2018 and helped recruit candidates to run last cycle for local, state, and national office. Crow says it's critical for the party to reintroduce itself to voters who feel like there's no place for them there.
We have an issue with how we're perceived in vast swaths of America, rural America, working class America. And what I know is that, you know, no slogan, no branding, no top line messaging are going to get us out of this.
New Mexico Congressman Gabe Vasquez agrees.
You know, you have to show up. You have to communicate with folks. I don't think there's a special formula of what media you do it on, how you do it. It's just taking the time to understand people's concerns or struggles and being there for them.
And although it seems like a long time between now and next November, building that kind of relationship that helps you win in tough areas takes time. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
The K-pop band NewJeans, also known as NJZ, is locked in a legal battle with its record label Adore after a South Korean court blocked the group from commercial activities independent from Adore. The group made a surprise announcement to fans at a concert in Hong Kong on Sunday. Charisse Pham reports.
Five-member girl group NewJeans took the music industry by storm in 2023 with their playful tunes and catchy lyrics. But they stunned fans, who called themselves bunnies, in Hong Kong on Sunday, announcing they'd be taking an indefinite break. The decision comes after a court ruled against NewJeans in an ongoing dispute with their record label. Here's the group speaking to fans, according to multiple videos posted on social media, including this one, posted on YouTube channel As One.
Out of respect for the court's decision, we've decided to pause all our activities for now, and it wasn't an easy decision, but we believe this is something we need to do at this moment.
In 2023, NewJeans became the fastest K-pop act ever to reach a billion streams on Spotify. Their single OMG went viral on TikTok. And their second album, Get Up, topped the Billboard charts in 2024. The meteoric rise came to a halt when NewJeans moved to cut ties with their record label Adore late last year. The group held an emergency press conference, alleging they'd been mistreated and manipulated by Adore. Here's NewJeans member, Hani.
This is not the type of work ethic we respect nor want to be a part of. And to continue working under a company with no intention of protecting NewJeans would only do us harm.
Then the group officially changed its name in November.
We're NJZ!
It's official.
They revealed it to CNN ahead of the official announcement.
It feels like a new beginning. It feels fresh, exciting, and we just can't wait to get back there and meet bunnies. We are so very excited.
Adore disputes the girl group's allegations. The record label maintains that NewJeans remains under contract, meaning its members can't perform or organize events without the label's approval. Last week, a South Korean court sided with Adore, ruling that NewJeans, even using the name NJZ, must not conduct any independent activities. That includes performing and signing advertising deals. NJZ said on Sunday they accept the court's ruling, but had to speak up to protect themselves.
We truly believe that standing up for our dignity, our rights, and everything we just deeply care about is something that we had to do, and that belief will not change.
The group said they plan to challenge the court's decision. For NPR News, I'm Charisse Pham in Hong Kong.
Make it feel like a game. Look at us, we go on and on again. We'll go on to the end. What we wanna do on and on again. Make it feel like a game. Look at us, we go on and on again. We'll go on to the end. What we wanna do on and on again. Look, it's a new me. Switched it up. Who's this? Did I buy new jeans? So fresh, so clean.
This is NPR News.
We're inside a Chinese restaurant, or as it would be known here in Beijing, a restaurant. We're reporting from here, and on the next morning edition, we will hear what a Chinese scholar thinks about Donald Trump's America. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, how religious leaders across the country are responding to President Trump's crackdown on immigration.
Some are still trying to offer sanctuary.
Jesus himself, before he was born, his parents sought sanctuary.
That's ahead. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Washington, D.C., the Trump administration is challenging a federal judge's order aimed at halting the deportation of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador. The D.C. Appeals Court is hearing the case after the administration flew hundreds of migrants without due process more than a week ago to a prison in El Salvador against the judge's orders. During today's hearing, attorney Patricia Millett said many of those arrested had no ties to gangs and were rounded up unlawfully.
There were plane loads of people. There were no procedures in place to notify people. Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemy Act than has happened here.
The federal judge who halted the flight says the pause does not prevent the government from making arrests or even deporting those it suspects of being members of a notorious gang. The administration plans to shutter the Department of Education, and it has met its first court challenge. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny tells us a group of unions, school districts, and educators filed suit today saying the effort seeks to overhaul 46 years of congressional decision-making.
The lawsuit comes just a few days after President Trump signed an executive order directing the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, to, quote, take all steps necessary to facilitate the closure of the department. Trump later announced that the Health and Human Services Department would oversee nutrition programs and special education services, and that the Small Business Administration would take over the federal student loan portfolio, which amounts to about $1.6 trillion in debt. The Education Department was formally created by Congress in 1979, and it cannot be closed without Congress's consent. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished broadly higher on Wall Street today. You're listening to NPR News. If you pay attention to how you look in virtual meetings, but not how you sound, you might want to think again. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce tells us about a new study showing that higher quality audio can create better impressions.
Cognitive scientists at Yale University made recordings of people speaking in a variety of contexts. Here's one from a job interview scenario.
My tenacious and proactive approach resulted in numerous important contract wins.
Then the researchers altered the recordings to create lower quality versions.
My tenacious and proactive approach resulted in numerous important contract wins.
People who heard the high quality audio were consistently more likely to have favorable impressions of the speaker, seeing them as more intelligent, attractive, and convincing. A report on this research appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
On the subject of impressions, President Trump is demanding a Republican commission portrait of him be taken down from the Colorado Capitol, claiming it was purposefully distorted. Trump says he's gotten plenty of complaints about the image that was painted during his first term and unveiled 5 years ago. Republicans raised more than $10,000 to commission the oil painting, but Trump says he would prefer no picture at all than the one currently up there. One visitor said the president looked a little chubby. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A lot of people have been accidentally added to a chat or to an email chain that wasn't intended for them, right? Well, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, was recently added by mistake to a group text with far-reaching consequences. It was a thread on the encrypted messaging app Signal, a thread with top U.S. national security leaders, including the Vice President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense. And this thread was discussing imminent military strikes on Yemen. Jeffrey Goldberg recounts the entire story in a piece in The Atlantic today. It's called "The Trump Administration Accidentally Texted Me Its War Plans." He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, first, can you just very briefly explain what exactly happened to you?
So I was on Signal. I was invited. I got a message request a couple of weeks ago from Mike Waltz, who is the National Security Advisor. I've met him in the past. Didn't strike me as completely unusual thing to happen. So I said yes, didn't think much of it. A couple of days later, I get invited, or I'm included in a group chat called Houthi PC Small Group. PC in White House parlance stands for Principals Committee. And I look at the group, it's 18 people or so, and it includes the what I take to be the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Vice President, CIA Director, and so on. Now, I assume that I'm being hoaxed. I assume that either this is a foreign intelligence operation or an organization that tries to, you know, set up journalists or embarrass them or,
exactly,
or feed them misinformation. It's some sort of disinformation campaign. So I'm very curious about this, so I watch it unfold. It unfolds in a very kind of credible way. I'm flummoxed by this because, and I guess this is a failure of imagination on my part, I did not think that the CIA and the Defense Department and the Secretary of Defense would invite the editor of The Atlantic into a chat about bombing
on Signal.
Yemen. Yeah, about not just bombing, not just a policy discussion about what do we do about the Houthis, but about talking about plans.
Like and actual messaging.
Yeah, just messaging, messaging and you know, it got to the, and then it gets to the point. I mean, to make a long story short, you could read it on theatlantic.com if you want to see the whole thing. To make a long story short, by Saturday the 15th, the text chain is filled up with what I would call operational military information of the sort that I'm not comfortable sharing, obviously.
But just to describe that, information about the targets, weapons that the U.S. would be using, and how the attacks would be sequenced, right?
Yes. I'm sitting in my car in a parking lot in a supermarket at 11:44 a.m. Eastern, and I get this war plan from Pete Hegseth. And it basically says, in 2 hours' time, you'll begin to see the effects of the bombing. And so I think to myself, well, I'm going to find out if this is real or not in 2 hours. I hold my phone very tightly because I don't want anybody getting my phone, obviously. And sure enough, around 1:50 p.m. Eastern, there starts to filter reports on social media of strikes in Yemen.
Right, because you're still not sure this is real. So you checked X and searched Yemen, and then you saw that explosions were
And then obviously as the day wore on, this channel on Signal came alive with senior officials congratulating each other on a successful strike.
Emojis.
Including emojis, which, you know, I guess
American
all people
flag,
are the
fist,
same. Yeah,
fire.
I mean, yeah, fire emojis and muscle emojis. And you know, and it's every workplace in some weird way is the same, I suppose.
Can I just ask you, though, normally such extremely sensitive information, it's shared under very secure conditions, right? Like
yes,
in SCIF, sensitive compartmented information facilities.
No, it's not supposed to be on Signal.
Right.
And obviously they're not supposed to invite people they don't even know the identity of to
Including journalists.
Including and especially magazine editors. Yes, that is true. At that point, I'm not kidding around here. I sort of felt a chill. Like it was a chilling thing to realize that I've inadvertently discovered a massive security breach in the national security system of the United States, because I'm sitting in a parking lot of a Safeway watching this thing unfold on my phone, and I have to make certain decisions about what to do, and I decided that, well, I'm going to write about this because it's in the public interest to know that there's this flaw. I also, as I state in the story, I am not going to readily share very specific technical information about
America. Understand the sensitivity of this. Can I just say that today, President Trump told reporters he did not know anything about this, but a spokesperson from the National Security Council has said, quote, the message thread that was reported appears to be authentic, and we are reviewing how an inadvertent number was added to the chain. I am sure, Jeffrey, as you were watching this thread unfold, were you like, why isn't anyone on this thread raising concerns about war plans being detailed on a messaging app?
That was one concern. The other is, was anybody curious about who JG was on the chat? And by the way,
As in Jeffrey Goldberg, right.
or not, as the case may be, there's a JG out there who probably was wondering why it wasn't included in the chat.
Let me ask you this. Trump's national security team has been criticized for its lack of experience. Do you think that lack of experience was on display here?
I think that's self-evidently the case. I think having good operational security is kind of a prerequisite for these jobs. These are the most serious jobs in America. They are sending Americans into harm's way to carry out national security missions on behalf of the United States. They shouldn't be texting each other operational information,
right.
And they shouldn't should know who they're this is the universal problem. Know who you're texting. Right?
Exactly.
You have to know.
Lawmakers are having a field day with the Democrats, like Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, who wrote on X, notice to White House staff, your recklessness put the lives of those pilots at risk. You got lucky. Time to reevaluate the way you are doing things. So I'm wondering, aside from criticism and ridicule from politicians, what sort of real fallout do you expect from this, if any?
I don't know. This is a very unorthodox administration, as you know. Ordinarily, people would be held accountable for these kind of mistakes. I don't know if there's going to be accountability. I would hope, obviously, just as an American, I would hope that they would take operational security and digital hygiene and communications hygiene more seriously than they did. But in terms of the fallout, I couldn't possibly predict because the ball bounces in weird ways in this administration.
You decided voluntarily to leave the group chat on Signal. Curious why.
I'm not actually comfortable talking about what I read that was highly sensitive, and I'm not comfortable talking about that decision. If you just bear with me on that as I work through some journalism issues.
Well, we'll have to wrap it there. Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Wildfires in the Carolinas have been burning since last week. In western North Carolina, firefighters are still struggling to contain them. A few homes have been destroyed, and several neighborhoods had to be evacuated. Blue Ridge Public Radio's Gerard Albert III reports these fires are burning in an area which was damaged by Hurricane Helene just 6 months ago.
Polk County, a rural area about an hour south of Asheville, was struggling to recover from Hurricane Helene. Then came the fires. Three of them are currently burning almost 5,000 acres, mostly in rural areas of the Appalachian Mountains. The county's emergency manager, Bobby Arledge, says Helene has made things worse.
All the debris and the blowdowns and stuff from the hurricane is doing nothing but fueling these fires. The longer they lay there and the longer they dry out, the worse the fire burns.
The state's Forest Service is leading the firefighting efforts. Along with help from local departments, there are now about 200 firefighters. and more are on the way this week. But officials aren't feeling optimistic. Jeremy Waldrop is a spokesman for the Forest Service.
That storm, when it came through, it's changed how we are fighting fire currently. We're having to assess things. We're having to go use different tools that are in the process of being made.
Like new digital maps. The amount of downed trees, what firefighters refer to as fuel, is enormous. But it's not the only way damage from the storm is making it harder to fight the fires. E.J. Dwiggins is also with the state's Forest Service. He says steep roads and bridges along the Green River, where the two biggest fires are burning, are barely repaired after the storm.
Access has been an issue with small gravel roads, usually one way in, one way out, so it's really hard to get resources into where these fires are.
Officials were cautiously optimistic that rain on Sunday night would help slow the fires. Dwiggins says the rain has only made things worse.
That limited amount of precipitation that we received has now made some of these roads slippery and wet. Some of our fire lines have become kind of muddy and slick. So that's another thing that our firefighters are going to have to deal with out there today.
North Carolina Governor Josh Stein said Sunday that the state was approved for a federal fire management assistance grant. It will help cover the costs of fighting the fire. Arledge with Polk County says it's a small relief for residents still trying to recover from the worst storm in the state's history.
We lost multiple houses down there. People are still trying to recover. So this fire now, though, on top of that, it's been a nightmare for those people who live in that area.
Two fires are still growing, and another one burning in South Carolina is coming closer to the North Carolina border. For NPR News, I'm Gerard Albert III in Asheville.
It's been a couple turbulent months at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that turmoil is taking a toll on the agency's development efforts in rural places, efforts like building water systems for small towns.
In a lot of these communities, USDA Rural Development is the most important partner. You can't rely on private investment coming in. The market's just often not there for it. You can't rely on philanthropy.
That's tomorrow on this show. You can listen on your local member station or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. On his first full day in office, President Trump rescinded restrictions on immigration officers arresting people at sensitive locations, places like hospitals and churches. Faith groups have sued the federal government over the change. They say it infringes on their religious freedom. Last month, a federal judge in Maryland temporarily blocked the Trump administration from sending immigration agents into the Quaker, Baptist, and Sikh congregations that sued.
But that ruling doesn't cover other houses of worship across the country who say the uncertainty has had a chilling effect on their ministries. We'll now hear from three reporters who talk to religious leaders across the country about how they are dealing with the confusion and ambiguity while trying to stay true to their religious values. We start this report with Patrick Davis in Austin, Texas.
For Reverend Jim Rigby at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, one question is top of mind.
What are the plans if ICE does knock on the door right now?
Well, that's what I'm feverishly trying to figure out. Like, I'm trying to talk to lawyers.
Since 2016, St. Andrew's Church has sheltered Hilda Ramirez and her son, Yvonne. They fled Guatemala to escape domestic violence and first reached the U.S. in 2014. Ramirez applied for asylum when she arrived, but was denied. Ramirez has talked to NPR in the past, but doesn't feel safe giving interviews since President Trump, who campaigned on promises of mass deportation, took office in January. While Rigby is seeking legal advice, he's also looking for direction in his Bible.
To me, the bottom line is more gospel than it is legal. If there is religious liberty, we should have religious liberty to obey Scripture and its commandment to treat the immigrant as well as we treat citizens.
Others at St. Andrew's are talking directly about how to deal with a potential ICE raid. Reverend Babs Miller has hosted two ICE seminars in the church sanctuary.
We know that Hilda and Yvonne have a target on their back because they have been very outspoken about their situation. We've done everything we can to make sure that even though they have that target, they're safe here.
Miller said that Ramirez was issued a stay until 2026 and that her son Yvonne now has a green card. Still, Miller said, doubts remain.
In the best of worlds, they both would be very, very safe. In our current world, we don't know.
In this climate of uncertainty, Miller said the St. Andrew's congregation cannot make any assumptions. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Davis in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Sarah Ventry. Churches like St. Andrew's are doing this work because they believe they have a religious obligation to do it. Linda Rabin is a professor at the University of Maryland who's written about the idea of sanctuary.
Jesus himself, before he was born, his parents sought sanctuary.
Rabin says that during the 1980s, when the sanctuary movement started, it was reported that there were more than 400 congregations involved. Sanctuary has often meant that the person or family being housed is under immediate threat of deportation.
So if they give shelter to somebody, they are not protected by the law to do that.
But now, under the Trump administration, churches are thinking more expansively about the concept to include migrants who fear that new policies could suddenly make them vulnerable to arrest or deportation. Many pastors say they're concerned about their flocks.
We now have signs up saying that ICE are not able to enter the space without a signed judicial warrant.
Reverend Ashley McFell Irwin is the pastor at Lakeview Presbyterian Church in Chicago. She says that while her congregation was doing immigration work before the election, they've had to step up their efforts since then.
We have held multiple trainings for church members because on Sunday mornings we are a public building and our doors are open. And so we just feel like it's best to be prepared.
McFell Irwin and others say that when the church is open for worship is when they're most vulnerable. Asked for comment about the Trump administration's change in the sensitive locations policy, Department of Homeland Security spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin said in part, "Our officers use discretion. Officers would need secondary supervisor approval before any action can be taken in locations such as a church or a school. We expect these to be extremely rare." Lakeview Presbyterian has housed two different families since October 2023. The congregation knew they wanted to, but weren't sure they could manage it logistically. But then community volunteers gave them some encouragement.
We had what at that point was a Sunday school classroom, but it actually has a little kitchen in there. And they were like, you know, this could pretty easily be turned into a studio apartment.
McFaul Irwin said she wanted to keep the details about the family living there private. With so much uncertainty, she doesn't want to take any chances with their safety. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
I'm Anna King in Central Washington State. This is ag land. Think hops, cherries, apples. For generations, the people here have relied on migrant labor to harvest the crops. Bishop Joseph Tyson is the leader of the Yakima Diocese. He says more than 30% of his parishioners are likely in the country without legal status.
I'm heartened that we haven't had a noticeable drop in numbers at our Sunday masses in Spanish. Folks are coming.
Tyson says people should be able to flee violence and poverty, and the United States has sent mixed messages to potential migrants.
We're saying, yeah, we need your work, but no, don't come. But yes, come, but don't come. The goalposts have moved around a lot.
The Yakima Diocese isn't publicly offering sanctuary in their churches, but Catholics in the diocese are offering legal advice and places to hide for vulnerable migrants. Jesus Mariscal is the parochial vicar of St. Paul Cathedral in the Yakima Diocese. After one service, several of his Anglo parishioners messaged him privately. He read a text from one.
If ever you know or hear of someone who needs a place to literally hide from ICE, send them to my house. The key is under the front mat. And then they gave me the address.
Mariscal says before he became a priest, he was a kid who crossed the border without documentation at 12. He says it's a beautiful feeling to know people who are generous and who risk their lives to offer sanctuary for others.
And I feel like my chest is filled with something in my mind, and I feel like my brain also, the blood rushes to my head and I get goosebumps. And I get watery eyes. That's how the feeling I get when I get these offers from these people.
For NPR News, I'm Anna King in Yakima, Washington.
This story was co-reported by Anna King at Northwest Public Broadcasting, Sarah Ventry, and Patrick Davis. You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the John D. and...
Somebody's hiding, it's crowding my eyes.
KSDP.